Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Aparuta de sangamatasa tawara ye sodavanta bamunjantu satang.
So this is the Uposatha, and two more weeks we will enter the Vasa, the annual retreat time. And then on Sunday, there's a celebration at Chithurst, 25 years at Chithurst, and also a celebration of the new Dharma Hall, which is finished building, and that's good to see, because Chithurst was our first monastery. And when we, and I was living at Chithurst for the first 5 years after 2 years in London, and then the community kept growing, expanding to where we couldn't fit any more into Chithurst, so we had to move to acquire this property. So this is also the 20th year that we've been here. We came in 1984. To Amaravati. And the idea then was that Chithurst, because of its unique situation, its forest, its beauty, and also our agreements with the council not to to make it a kind of center where it would draw thousands of the faithful, and also we wanted to keep it more in the ambience of a forest monastery, then the aim was to draw the attention away from Chithurst. So we did, and came here. And so the emphasis of establishing this, so I asked Ajahn Sujito, you know, to refrain from any big building plans till we finish this. And so 5 years ago, this temple was finished, and so the Dharma Hall at Chithurst has been being built and is now, I hope, finished. And so these are just memories of time, coming to England in 1977. So this is my 28th year, 28th Vasa in the UK. But the effects of meditation over the years is that time doesn't have much reality anymore. And so you, because a mindfulness is a connection going back to the timeless rather than clinging to perceptions of time. So we have these memories when we started, when we came, when we arrived, when we established Chithurst, established Amaravati, building the temple here, building the Dharma Hall there, and on like this, people coming and going, changing conditions. But the sense of reality in regard to the conditioned realm begins to lose its power. And this is where this reflection on impermanence, all conditions are impermanent, is so helpful. Because we are conditioned to think of things as something more than what they are. Every thought that we project into consciousness is makes something more than what it is. Thinking is like that. It's a compounding. It's adding to the present moment. So, for example, at this moment now, this is, you know, when we just are aware, we're not thinking. We're not trying to describe what we're aware of. We're just aware, just open to this present moment. And then we project words onto it. This is the Amravati temple. This is the Oposita day, 2 weeks until the beginning of Vata, and on like this. These are projections, adding something to the present. So thinking itself is a function of the mind, you know, and it is conditioned. So we have various languages, and we learn to think in certain ways according to cultural identities and so forth, but the awareness, say, isn't identified with any particular language or culture. And yet, modern society is so attached to thinking. We want to define everything, explain everything, elaborate, complicate in every way we can. Everything becomes complicated by how we think about ourselves, the Sangha, Buddhism, England, whatever. We're making it more than what it is. So this is like this sense of compounding, this habit of projecting, making something more than what it is. So the emphasis the Buddha made on mindfulness, or satipanya, is to stop doing it, just to notice the way it is, to trust the attention, the conscious reality of this moment, rather than trying to define it, describe it, make it into something more than what it is. Because we tend to believe our projections more than the reality of this moment. Is this really the Amravati temple? And we give significance to Amravati temple. This is the compounding this moment. But it is the way it is. So this does not emotionally satisfy us, because when we get into language and that, we like to feel good about it. This is a beautiful temple, this is our temple, this is, or we become critical of it. We spend our time noting the things we don't like about it. But seldom do we really rest in the present, just realizing that this moment is the way it is, the as-isness, the suchness. And so in Vipassana meditation, that's what we're learning to do, to give up projecting, adding to, but recognizing and realizing Dhamma, which doesn't have a name. So we use terms like the way it is. And of course, the thinking mind, if we're attached to thinking, it makes us very uncomfortable, because we want to describe the way it is. We want somebody to tell me, Ajahn, what is it? You know, what is the way it is? And who am I? Tell me who I am and what I should be or become. So it's the world of desire is like that, wanting to become, wanting to control, wanting to get rid of things we don't like, trying to suppress, deny, exterminate, extirpate that which is we don't like, don't want, and try to hold on to and keep what we like and what we prefer. And we can always imagine how things should be or shouldn't be. But the reality of the way it is, this isn't emotionally satisfying, and that's why it is a difficult practice, because emotionally we go into the state of uncertainty and insecurity. And we don't like that. We don't want to feel insecure and not knowing, because the desire to know everything, to have an answer to every question, a solution to every problem, a description of everything, to know everything about everything, to be an expert, to be an authority, these are highly valued goals in life for many human beings. And yet it's the cause of our suffering, this attachment to the desires, isn't it? Kama dana, pava dana, vipava dana. This blind attachment, ignorant attachment, identity, is the cause of suffering. So we create suffering. And then we want to blame it on somebody else or something. Because, you know, the tendency, who's to blame? And then we see it in the news, who's to blame now for the mess in Iraq and for the inadequate intelligence around the weapons of mass destruction? I want to blame somebody. His desire to, that would make us feel good. We could find somebody, a scapegoat, something else out there to blame for our unhappiness, our suffering. So that's desire again, isn't it? Desire to know something, to have something that makes us feel more secure if we can figure out things rationally, and then really, who is the culprit? Who can we blame? Who can we put the blame on for this suffering we're experiencing? So with awareness, we're noticing this turning the light on from inside, this movement of thought and desire towards wanting to define, to blame, to know something. So what we can really know is not through projecting thoughts, ideas, views and opinions into consciousness, but by knowing in this direct way, because mindfulness is knowing. It's a direct knowing. It's not me knowing. It's not like I know everything. But the more I trust in the awakened attention to this moment, there's a certainly knowing it is the way it is. Now that doesn't seem like one is knowing very much, but that's very profound actually. It sounds even stupid or ridiculous to many people. But knowing the way it is in order to really to know that is to open to this moment, to receive it. And that receptive ability has no boundary. Mindfulness is boundless. It doesn't have any form. So when you try to become mindful through some idea you have about what mindfulness is, you're never there. I remember I used to do that a lot in the early years. You know, read about mindfulness and then try to become mindful all the time. Because I defined mindfulness. I tried to get the definition from the Pali Dictionary and what the meditation manuals would say and the various other views about mindfulness. And then, So I tried to make myself do what I would regard as mindful. But I was it was because I was holding to a view of mindfulness. And until I saw that, saw the attachment to a view or a definition, no matter how accurate or good that definition might be, that attachment to an idea or a definition of mindfulness was the problem. The ignorance, the avijja, bhajya sankhara, out of ignorance comes the sankhara, the conditions that we project. So in vipassana, we're actually, just noticing, because there's so many, conditioned phenomena, what we're experiencing all the time. It's the body itself, this physical body, and the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, the body, the mental states, the thoughts, the memories, they're all sankharas, the subtle, coarse, whatever. And we're very attached to some of these sankharas. We'd like to get rid of greed, hatred, and delusion in that way. But there is a tremendous fear of disappearing, of annihilation. Because the sense of oneself, the very attachment to being somebody, having an identity, having a position, having a role, all these are strong desires to know who I am, to define myself, maybe by my position, by my past, by my memories. So I think I have to make myself into somebody, I have to become somebody. So even in monastic life, when the Buddha established the Sangha, the monastic Sangha, it was not to increase the ego and to become a monk or nun is not to increase the sense of self, but to help reflect, to be a convention that reflects the ego, the sense of myself. So then, if I'm a senior monk, that kind of thing is identifying with, you get titles now, and this makes you somebody, and it's not just an ordinary monk, but a special monk, or a special nun, or a teacher, or an expert. There's nothing wrong with this. This is perfectly all right. But if it blinds us, if we're in this life in order to become somebody, then we're kind of misusing we're missing the opportunity that's made available to us. But it's not to deny either. It's not to say, to grab some kind of idea of being nobody. I'm just nobody. But with awareness, we actually see this dualism that we create through thinking. If I'm somebody, then there's nobody along with that. And that the more proud and arrogant a person is, the more they fear being humiliated and life proving that they're not worth anything. If your identity is based on being a winner or a special, advanced kind of gifted human being, then along with that identity comes also the fear of losing it, of being a failure, a nobody. So you can see in the society around us how much misery and depression there is. People who have become somebody, and then it changes, and they're no longer the special somebody or the important person they used to be. And then one sinks into depression, despair, disappointment. Because now all I'm left with is a sense of I'm a failure and I'm nobody. Nobody loves me anymore. And my life is a failure. Now with awareness, this dualistic thinking process can be seen in perspective. You know, so with awareness, you know, it contains both right and wrong, good and bad, and success and failure, praise and blame. Where thinking limits you to one or the other in the present moment. You can only have one thought moment at a time. So if you're attached to thinking and definition and ideas and so forth, then it will take you, you know, you go around with it. You go from the top to the bottom, from success to failure to success to failure to hope to despair, happiness and misery. Because the conditioned realm is like that. It's always in this state of flux. It's ephemeral. You can't fix success, happiness, and praise, petrify them into a permanent state of being, because the conditioned realm isn't like that. So recognizing this, realizing awareness, the value, the beauty, the great gift we have of awakening and being that which is aware, present here and now, where the ego and all its variations and permutations can be seen, not criticized or denied, but recognized. When you practice like this, you can, you know, you begin to notice what the Sakkaya Ditti, in the Pali terms of the 10 fetters, Sakkaya Ditti is. You know, it's a me and mine and I am and I should and I shouldn't. It's Ajahn Sumedho and I'm an American and I'm a Buddhist. And you know, all these things make me into somebody. It's an identity. But if I'm aware, then these are mere conventions. You know, they're no longer attachments. I no longer seek to identify with any perceptions. I don't, you know, there's no longer any interest in being anything or becoming anything. Because through investigation, they call yoniso manasikara, you're getting to the root. You're getting to the root cause of suffering. So you can see you don't have to suffer if you don't want to. Once you see the cause, it's no longer because of something else or the imperfections of the world or the inadequacies of the people around you or the society you're in. These things change. Sometimes they're better than at other times. They change. Conventional realm is imperfect. Its very nature is unsatisfactory. And yet we can imagine perfect conventions. And yet, you know, they are, you know, the ideals we have. You know, the ideal world that we can create, how things should be, according to the best possibility, the superlatives that we can create in our minds. But when the Buddha used the word Dhamma, this isn't pointing to the best. It's pointing to the way it is. The way it is, sometimes, it changes. Sometimes it's the best, sometimes the worst, and in various gradations between those two extremes, because that's what change is all about. It's a continual, relentless, inexorable movement of conditioned phenomena that we try to hold on to in some way. It's like hope and despair, isn't it? The future, hoping everything will be all right. When we're ignorant, then we think about the future a lot. And then you also, when you hope that everything's going to be all right, we also have the kind of dread that it's not going to be all right, that it's going to change, and we're going to lose everything, and everything's going to go wrong, it'll be a mess. Hope and despair, they go together. But in awareness, then hope can be seen, isn't it? It's a condition we create. It's not permanent, it has no core, no essence. We project hope into consciousness. And hope is quite positive. Hope everything will be just, will go well, and we'll get what we want and attain what we aspire to and so forth. But then there's also as the mood changes, the sense of dread or despair. Maybe I can't do it. Maybe I'm inadequate. Maybe nobody can do it. And then same with the religious path we're in, with Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism. Hope it's the right one, and maybe it's not. Maybe it's not the path for me. It might be some other path. So doubt. But Theravada Buddhism is a convention, so it's not meant to be something to solve your problems and to give you security. The whole structure of the Dhamma Vinaya is for reflection and liberation, not for identity or attachment. Now, people want peace. This is the cry of the present age. We want peace. We don't want any more wars. We don't want a society with all kinds of conflicts in it and problems and poverty. And we want to get rid of poverty. And we want justice, fairness, peace, happiness. And these are all very good ideals. It's not cynically condemning them in any way, but no, that's what they are. That the longing for peace, and yet peace, when we have it, we don't want it. Is that we want excitement, romance, adventure. We want to feel alive that we have our life has a meaning and a purpose, and that I'm, have this hope in the future that I'll achieve and attain and find and experience and realize and get and become. So it's the way the mind works. So the awareness then is, to be aware of that. That's all that needs to be done. It's not to say you shouldn't feel that. You shouldn't have those thoughts or you shouldn't attach to anything. That's another problem in this, we get the idea we shouldn't be attached to anything. So we grasp the idea of non-attachment. And we're attaching, you know, grasping the very concept of non-attachment. And the only way you can get beyond that is by recognizing what it is. Knowing what an idea is, a thought, an emotion, a feeling, an intuition. You know, these are mental states that we experience. Inspiration. And all these kind of, you know, we want inspiration. We love to be inspired because it makes us feel good. Falling in love, being in love makes us feel alive. And so having exciting lifestyle, going places, doing exciting things, adventures, are, you know, they're very attractive, very stimulating goals to seek. And yet, can we really look at that? You know, it's difficult sometimes because we want them so much. We don't want to detach. We want to follow those moods, those inspirations, those longings. Because the very idea of not having them can seem like a desert, desolation, misery, boredom. And that's because of the way the thinking process works. It lifts us up, and then with its opposite we fall into despair. Inspiration is definitely, takes you to desperation, disillusionment. Now, I'm not condemning inspiration, but to recognize its limitation, to see what it is, and not to depend on it, not to seek it as your refuge, to always need to be inspired, to be praised, to feel that you are somebody, or you're getting somewhere, or you're going in the right direction, that you're doing the right thing, that everything is, that we're the best group, and our ways are, you know, you're sure to get there if you stick with it, and so forth. Guarantees. How many of you want guarantees when you become samanas, that this way you're going to really, you know, you're going to get enlightened? If you do it, if you practice our way. So even with the best convention, the most, you know, or with a very skillful convention that we have, we can attach to that convention. And then it's going to disappoint us. Because as much as it inspires and gives us hope and so forth, it will take us to its opposite. If we don't awaken to the way it is. Now with the holy life, this life that we're living is not meant to be in a kind of asceticism of denial and torture. We're not trying to control ourselves and bind ourselves because we're so afraid of our emotions, our passions. And yet that's oftentimes how it can look, you know, especially to the Western way of thinking. This is a life to be really treasured and loved and enjoyed. And so this how to, you know, and yet I can't. This is something I can't command you to do. You know, it's not that you should love this life, because this can't be demanded of anyone, but encouraged is a way of life for reflection. It's a good way of life, isn't it? It's based on moral precepts, on being responsible for action and speech. It's an honorable, it has a nobility and a sense of honor in it. So in terms of ideals, we can idealize the monastic life. How many of you, you know, have been disappointed in the members of the Sangha as you get to know them, because they don't live up to what you expect, your ideals of what a good Buddhist monk or a Buddhist nun should be, or a Buddhist? I've heard so many people say, you know, I joined the Buddhist society and I was so upset because there's so much jealousy and backbiting and things going on in there, and Buddhists shouldn't be acting like that. The idea that if it's a Buddhist society, you know, then they're all going to be Buddhas, enlightened Buddhas. But this is, and that's, you know, projecting this idea that Buddhists are not like anyone else. But we share our humanity with all other human beings. You know, that's whether, you know, it's terrorists or criminals, serial killers, saints, and whatever, we have a common human bond, you know. We have this humanity to live with. Like being human, isn't it? We're not Buddha Rupas. We're not made of bronze or marble, we're made of the four elements, earth, fire, water, and air. Consciousness, we're conscious beings. We're in this incessant changingness. We all have our own karmic idiosyncrasies. So you're never going to find two the same. And so we project our ideals of what a good Buddhist should be, and then we're going to be disappointed because we aren't going to find any. You know, every human being is going to disappoint you if you're expecting them to be an ideal human being, a perfect human being. But it's better to look at it like all human beings, no matter what, are perfect because they are human. Perfectly human, whether they're crazy or normal. And so this humanity is not something to despise, but to recognize, like this awakening, isn't it? Awakening to the way it is. We're not judging humanity as some kind of inferior conditioned phenomena that we're a bit ashamed of and try to suppress or deny, but open to the fact of having a human body, senses, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, having a mind that thinks and emotions and passions and experiences, all kinds of mental experiences, sensible, nonsensical, whatever. So this awareness then is that which is aware of humanity, you know, not criticizing it, diminishing it, denying it, but recognizing that whatever we call human is still conditioned, and the identity isn't. We're not saying we're human as an identity for our egos, but as a way of reflecting on what is being human. What do we mean by that word? Because sometimes we think we know what it is, and we don't. It's a common enough word. But what is a human being in terms of this moment, in terms of your own experience? So we're not starting from defining things and then trying to fit life into definitions, but by learning to trust in a direct knowing, this jnana-dasana, this ability of awakened, intelligent awareness. Awakenness, sati-sampajanya, is intelligence. It's not going into some zombie-like trance or stupidity. You know, it's aware, it's bright, it's clear. Once you begin to recognize it, realize it, and surrender to that. So I use the word surrender. Now, surrender is another word people find difficult because giving up and surrendering to something, giving up. But giving up in this sense is like letting go of ignorance, letting go of desire. So this surrender then has a very positive sense of it. Instead of getting rid of, it's not a letting go or surrendering to somebody or something, but through awareness, learning to relax and be that which is aware, rather than somebody who is trying to become aware. So this is what I'm doing now, is just pointing, isn't it, to this word sati sampajanya. Sampajanya, this is like intuitive awareness, isn't it? It's receptive to the way it is. All that's present now in all its subtleties or coarseness, whatever. Internal, what's going on inside your mind, how you're feeling, and so forth, and the external impingement. And so awareness, we find it's a natural state. We don't create it. It's not like a special state that depends on controlling a situation so that these coarser, unpleasant impingements are diminished. Then we want to go to heavenly state, to some kind of refined state that we can only attain through controlling our mind or the world around us. But sati sampajanya it's wherever we are. It includes all that we're experiencing, whether it's peace or confusion, pleasure or pain. So what is that right now? And so when I say, what is that right now? This just by training, by practicing, by developing this awareness, it's this natural state. I rest in it. It's not something created. Lungpa Cha used to, use the term our real home. This is our real home, where, it's not something that that depends on conditions supporting it anymore. It's natural. It's Dhamma. And therefore, to recognize, like in the terminologies of Theravada Buddhism, this recognition, realization. And that is through noticing how things arise and cease, how conditioned, in just observing, arising and ceasing, in experience right now, thoughts come and go, emotions, they arise and then they cease. In that movement of conditioned phenomena, that awareness is a stable factor, isn't it? It's aware of its arising, its peak, its descent into cessation. So in the Four Noble Truths, when we talk about the reality, the realization of cessation, it's not realizing some kind of extinction or annihilation, as some kind of metaphysical concept. It's the reality of the cessation, thoughts, emotions, feelings, because that's their nature, is to cease. We don't make them, you know, if you try to get rid of them, then you're not doing it, you're not aware anymore. As soon as you resist and fight and try to get rid of something you don't like, then you're no longer mindful. So you're just creating more karma, you're creating more attachments to that, the very thing you're trying to get rid of. Now that's why in the life, just learning to be patient, learning to receive life in its pleasure and pain, its happiness, its suffering, its successes and failures, its praise and blame. And then the reality of cessation is the path, really, which isn't annihilation again. It's allowing conditioned phenomena to be what it is, and no longer trying to make it into something more than what it is. So in patience, isn't it? Learning to be very patient with yourself, with your body, with your mental state, whatever they might be. In a monastic life, learning to, rather than try, you know, dwelling with criticism or discontent, or learn to be content in it. Reflect on the four requisites and the goodness of the life, to be content and have gratitude, the sense of katanyu, to feel that this builds a base of for realization. If we're not content and we're not grateful, then we're not going to ever get much peace or happiness out of this life. Because we can always, dwell on what we don't like about it, or what's wrong with it, or what's wrong with the people in it. And like any convention or any condition, you know, it has its good points and its flaws. You know, so if one has a critical mind, then one's always noticing the flaws. And we do this to ourselves. We are oftentimes more aware, and that we exaggerate. We obsess ourselves with our weaknesses or our flaws, our bad habits, and we can quite bypass, not notice our virtues. Awareness receives both and doesn't judge. Isn't a judging, condemning, for having any weaknesses or flaws, nor does it get attached to identifying with virtue. But it certainly knows virtue is like this. Weaknesses, faults, flaws are like this. So this gives you this unshakable refuge, that And the door to that unshakable refuge is the simple, immanent act of awareness. So it's a very direct and very clear path. But it does take incredible determination, because the eight worldly winds and the force of habit and the way we easily forget, the way our emotions can take us over. But I encourage you, it's learning to trust yourself, trust your awareness. Don't trust any of the opinions and views you have. I don't trust any of my opinions or views anymore at all. And people want me, ask me about, what do I think of Osho? What do you think of this group or that group? And I don't have any opinions. I don't want any opinions about things. These are perceptions. These are, I hear gossip, I hear all kinds of stories, and then I have preferences. Doesn't mean I don't have opinions, but I don't believe them. They aren't important. My opinions about anything are not important to me anymore, because you see through that how easily, easy for somebody like me to be very righteous and opinionated. When you have high standard of moral conduct and so forth, it's easy to have strong opinions about those who don't, and so forth. So I've noticed the suffering of being attached to even my righteous views and my moral judgments. It's not that they're wrong or bad, but the attachment to them can delude me, can take me over, and I can get caught in very unpleasant mental state by that kind of heedlessness. So in this way too, it's a kind of freedom, like a sense of relief of not having to be the moral authority or the judge or, the one who decides what's right and what's wrong and tell you all about how you should live your life and who's a good guy and who ain't. To be the moral judge. It's no longer my, I'm relieved that I don't have to do that. Because that's suffering, to always be judging, criticizing, moralizing, choosing, condemning. And you see it all the time now, in the societies we live in, the kind of morality of war or immorality of war, and who's wrong, and the Al-Qaeda, the Islamic terrorists, the fundamentalist Christians in America, George Bush, Tony Blair and Berlusconi. The three B's. The three bad B's. But putting it in a context of Dhamma doesn't mean that I don't have, personally don't have preferences and feelings. But knowing them as that, rather than identifying, because this way is definitely a way of liberation. It's not, this is, you know, it's not meant to be make us stupid and just blind ourselves like the ostrich with its head in the ground, doesn't want to know anything. It's not that at all. One can still be aware of all these things, but that awareness then isn't attaching out of ignorance. It knows whatever I think of George Bush is just that. It's a thought. That isn't George Bush. It's a thought of perception I have. And that's what I can know, isn't it? That's what I can really know at this moment, that's what it is. So it's a memory, it's a perception that rises in consciousness. And that's what it is in regards to experience at this moment. Is that really George Bush? And yet I can, you know, if I'm not aware, I tend to believe my own views and perceptions of George Bush are actually George Bush. That applies to every one of you too. You know, when I go back to my kuti, I think of this person or that person. Is that the person? Or is that a memory I have of somebody? Is my memory a person? Is that a real person? Or is that, what is it? It is, in terms of Buddhist jargon, isn't it? Sanya Kanda. All sanya is impermanent. So it's learning to use the flow of experience for this investigation. So more and more your tendency to delude yourself, misinform, believe in your delusions, believe in your opinions and views as something more than what they are, that diminishes, that falls away to the reality of being in this reality of conscious experience now. So I offer this as a reflection for this evening.